From health and wellness to education,
we need to be thinking about what it takes for students to succeed.
From art and politics to social issues of the day,
we have young Black males who are thriving in their communities and who are being shown as leaders.
The journey is what matters.
I would say to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Let's join Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, president of Howard University, and his guests as they take steps on the journey.
Electoral politics and public policy. These are two of his passions. Dr. Lorenzo Morris, professor of political science at Howard University and chair of the Faculty Senate, is my guest today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Morris, you are a graduate of Fisk University.
Yes, indeed.
And attended Fisk University at an interesting time in its history. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell me what it was like being at Fisk in that time?
Well, it was exciting and it was inspiring for educational purposes because at that time, in the end of the 60s, we thought, and those of us in Black colleges that were liberal arts colleges, thought we had a real role to play in helping to reform the role of all African Americans in the nation, and that because there were so few of us. And just one brief story was that almost that many years, 47 years ago or a little bit more, it was 1968, the death of Martin Luther King was my senior year, something I don't usually admit because it dates me so well. And that in that April, we had to struggle to avoid the police as they sort of thought to quell what they suspected was a racial demonstration on the eve of King's death. But what is significant about that for me is because it defined a large part of my political interest, my academic interest. It defined that for many, whether they went into medicine or to law or elsewhere, they all had a sense of civic duty. And while that might have been upsetting, it inspired us all in ways that I think few events have.
Now, tying that to your interest today, as we talk about electoral politics, and obviously given especially the media's role, the rapid change in how we digest and receive our electoral politics is very different today.
Yes.
What is your perspective of where that is today?
You know, when I went to graduate school, I got attracted by philosophy of science. And then I turned away from that simply because of the language issue, the language and concepts that people use to define political events was so much more important than how you measured or analyzed things. And I began to look at minorities around the world and the ways in which they interacted with power. And in this country, over the years, the narrowness of access to political action, whether it is through political parties or through lobbying or elsewhere, meant that the ways in which we communicate about those narrow roads of access became increasingly important. To take the events of the past few months or weeks, we depend so much on the media to tell us not only what is happening, but how the distribution of power is working to affect what is happening. We don't know what is said, obviously, in closed circles, whether it is in international events or national, but we know how people react. We think we know, but that information has to be prepackaged because now we no longer have the easy access to individuals on the streets or in public places that we once had.
Now, that's an interesting perspective because it changes the paradigm given how quickly people react to news and, as you said, how prefabricated or prepackaged it is.
And it must be presented around active political groups. And since those usually require not only often a lot of money, but often greater organization. In the Civil Rights Movement, we had one thing we didn't have now, which is organization. Even if it wasn't powerful, it was sustained at some level and it was structured and there were leaders. It's good to have more individual action, but without those organizational venues, it's often difficult to know where our information is coming from and how it has been prevented. Take the numerous videos which have been shown after the fact of police involvements with victims who have been subject to apparent racial bias. That is structured for us by coincidence, but yet there is a whole structure that we would have previously had greater access to had we had a more active, we meaning African Americans, civil rights community, but that extends to white liberals and to a lesser extent to many political groups because the level of organization is no longer quite as sustained at the grassroots level as it once was.
So what would be your advice for the 21-year-old or the 20-year-old this year who will turn 21 next summer and can vote in November of 2016 in terms of how they digest all that they're getting to make a decision about which candidate they should vote for president?
Well, I would suggest they skip to the age of 60 and try to go back to the times they can be more active. But short of that, I think seriously that the opportunity for inaction is somehow precluded by the rapidity of communication. It used to be that if you did nothing, you would have the same kind of job. If you managed to get a job, you would have the same kind of opportunities, and your community would not be changed. Right now, if you sit back, whole neighborhoods can be devastated by redevelopment opportunities. If you sit back, obviously, control over police behavior, control over the effectiveness of the criminal justice system is moving drastically in diverse directions, sometimes horribly. If you sit back, the political party structure is changing. You no longer have unfettered access, unfettered by great wealth, as we once had before. But more importantly, if you see someone in the political world or if you see opportunities there that you may like, it will take major organizations just to communicate with them, whereas before you could sometimes walk up to them and shake their hand.
So although you present a daunting task, clearly engagement seems to be your solution to that daunting problem.
Organizations, just as people communicate rapidly, but whether it is tweeting or Facebook or who knows the other things I can't even say kinds of communication, or sustained organization, it gets a response. Those things only work because people organize. And ironically, with the greater inequality in wealth and distribution, very few people are willing to engage in sustained organization. So those numbers are not any greater than they were before. It is just the willingness of individuals. It means that just as an individual may too easily use the phone to communicate a message, that same individual can engage in sustained action. So the competition in some way is less if you're willing to be active, if you're willing to be continuous and sustained in your commitment to a cause.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Dr. Lorenzo Morris. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Now, let's just switch gears a bit. We've spoken about the state of U.S. electoral politics, but you are also well steeped in public policy and black politics, so much so that you spent as Fulbright Distinguished Chair in the French Institute of Geopolitics at the University of Paris in 2009. And you also have some interest in other Francophone areas. What is different about those communities in terms of what you see today here in the U.S., and what are some of the similarities?
Well, one of the ways to see yourself better is to see yourself or aspects of your life in others. I actually got interested in these minority issues by looking at the Francophone economic subjugation in Quebec, and that was my first article. I was able to predict in writing to some degree some of the success of some of their ethnic movements. So when I went to France as a requirement for passing a test, I remember in the PhD level at the University of Chicago, I remember staying and encountering people and talking to people about an emerging racial ethnic problem. I discovered that a big aspect of inequality in this society is the unwillingness to address race, so that in France it is illegal in many levels to even identify racial issues in public press. That meant that I was one of the few, but not that few, to discover the emerging housing inequality that led to big race riots in France in 2005. So when I went back, I joined French scholars who were new to the subject. But in that newness to the subject, they were like scholars in other parts of Europe, some of my students working in Great Britain, others working in Germany, who were looking at inequality in the way in which it's beginning to dominate, not to dominate, but certainly be preponderant in European politics. Ironically, for example, I learned that in Europe, black music and black beauty and other forms were highly praised, whereas other things were less.
Right. Very interesting. Now, you are obviously a chair of the Howard University Faculty Senate, and that puts you in a position to, I would say, to be the primary guardian of the shared governance that must exist at our institution in order to ensure appropriate governance. What's your take and scope on shared governance and
implemented. Normally, this might be a non-sensitive subject, but given the nature of our conversations, it's still worth exploring. And I want anybody to know I'm not being shackled at the moment when I say this, though I might feel that way. But really, shared governance is something that we often talk about when we're talking about individual or a collection of decision-making occasions in the university, but in some sense, it's a matter of shared shared values. I think that everyone should see in the university a responsibility of the faculty to assure the sustaining of and the promotion of its academic values, to assure that they are reviewed, judged, and protected in ways that are both empirical, concrete, and as well as sort of broadly spiritual and holistic. And I think only the faculty can do that, but only the faculty can interpret its responsibilities in ways that allows the rest of the university and certainly the administrative leadership to provide the kind of environment in which those things can be carried out, so that it is a balanced agreement in between all aspects of the university. And I think it's part of the value framework. What we have problems with is often it's difficult to decide when and where, but it is never difficult to decide that we want to do it.
Right. No, I think that's an excellent response. Unshackled or shackled. When you've been at Howard University long enough to see the change of the student body, to see people look who have a cause and are after a certain circumstance to change it, to some of the cynicism that exists about our youth today, which I have to admit I don't share. I think the young men and women who come here are as socially conscientious as can be. What is your perspective about what has changed the most and what we should celebrate?
I think many of us, a little bit of reflection on the debate between Booker T. Washington and W.E. Du Bois. In the College of Arts and Sciences, we use a phrase in our mission statement that comes from Du Bois, in which Du Bois equates a broad intellectual development with what he calls broad sympathy. That means understanding people in the world in ways that help you not just sympathize with them in an emotional or compassionate sense, but to see things from their perspective, but also to see yourself in different situations and to see the world changing. And that was pretty much the spirit that was indirectly, if not directly, imposed by the civil rights movement on African Americans when I was a student. It was also imposed by the leaps of progress that came in the 80s for African Americans. But now we are discouraged, and this always often happens when there's technical difficulty, technical meaning in the management of the economy. We discourage students, not just themselves, we discourage them from looking at anything but immediate job opportunities, understandably. But we often do it in what the Booker T. Washington's more narrow frame of some technical, magical scale. And I know I will alienate some people when I say this, looking for the magic of STEM before you see how the STEMs got there, how they're nourished, and how they're developed. And so when the students repeat are very often materialistic modes of expression about what a college education is for, we see them as uninspired. I think that the product comes in, and often the product goes out of Howard in the way that it should, but often it takes re-nurturing in the College of Arts and Sciences to get those kinds of students that we have seen before. Fortunately, they do come out with a broader sympathy, as Du Bois might say.
And you know, for the listeners, when we refer to STEM, we're talking about science, technology, engineering, and math. But as Dr. Morris, you just eloquently pointed out, it has to be underscored in a deeper understanding of how it impacts the world around us. I think to close, as you see black politics today, what would be your signature statement around that?
Well, I think it always was America's most concrete expression of its commitment to egalitarian principles, meaning African Americans had the weight of carrying, with those liberal whites who supported him, a fundamental principle of egalitarianism, not just in terms of law, but in terms of social behavior, whether it is health care, in terms of regulatory policy, and a broad interest in the inequality around the world. So I see that as there as what black politics becomes. It becomes more open in terms of racial group identity, but it maintains a core in the black community simply because we are the only ones constrained by history and opportunity to be tied to those egalitarian principles. And unfortunately, at some levels, by continuing racial difficulties to be committed in ways that others may not so readily be.
Thanks for being here. My guest today has been Dr. Lorenzo Morris. And I can safely say that as the 17th president, when I took this job, I never thought that I would be doing a radio show, and certainly never thought that I would be interviewing the faculty senate chair in such a fascinating 15 minutes. Thank you very much.
Well, I never thought I'd have such a fascinating opportunity.
Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, right here on the Howard University Radio Network.